supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia's Ben Franklin Parkway has become the go-to spot for large-scale events in the city, music festivals, parades, even a visit from the Pope. For nearby residents, it means lots of traffic headaches, and for city officials, it means finding ways to regularly break that unpleasant news to those neighbors. WHYY's Aaron Mozell took a look at the city's strategy for this month's NFL draft, as well as how it did and did not work out.
The draft will shut down the parkway for 3 days, mostly so thousands of fans can take advantage of a long list of free activities. There will be a 100-yard zip line and a chance to kick a regulation field goal. Not surprisingly, getting around that part of the city will be difficult then. It's not that easy now, as streets continue to close and crews in neon yellow vests scramble to build everything in time. Mayoral spokeswoman Lauren Hitt says the city started reaching out to every neighborhood group and cultural institution months ago via old school and new school methods, even before traffic restrictions were finalized.
We also have continued to meet with them since then to kind of hear other issues that have come up to try and deal and minimize with those.
Phone calls, email exchanges, tweets, and blog posts about parkway activities and road closures have also been part of the outreach effort, says Hitt.
I would just be kind of shocked if there were a significant number of people who didn't feel like they heard this. I have no doubt that there's, you know, one or two people who are complaining that we weren't thorough enough, and I think there always will be.
Drew Murray, president of the Logan Square Civic Association, agrees. The parkway is squarely inside his group's boundaries. The longtime resident says the city was thorough about communicating draft details.
Literally, when the draft was leaked by, I believe it was Congressman Brady, I got an email from the city that next morning apologizing for not coming to Logan Square Neighborhood Association first to tell us about the draft. They didn't want us to find out about it via the paper.
Murray says he's not thrilled about the disruption, but he feels ready to tackle it. And he commends the city for taking some extra steps to ensure nearby neighbors feel less put upon, placing porter potties outside the event, extending cleanup efforts beyond the parkway.
They've committed to get the trash cans to the communities sooner than they have in the past, because the Big Belly trash cans that are in our communities are shrink-wrapped for Homeland Security reasons.
Others are less pleased with the city's performance and say their neighbors feel the same way. Brian Shapiro moved to Fairmount about 5 years ago. He's not upset about the draft coming to town. He actually thinks it's a net positive for the city, that it will do wonders for its image. He just wishes the city had come to his community and briefed them, the way a good neighbor might if they were throwing a big party next door.
You still may not be happy about it. You still not be thrilled by the fact that you're going to be disturbed. But there's not the ancillary, I can't believe you didn't even talk to me. And I think that's the component where I don't take that personally. I take that as I think that's an area that the city can continue to work on.
Shapiro, who was in the communications business, says the city should also let neighbors know not just about traffic and road closures, but why an event like the NFL draft is worthwhile. Officials project the draft will score the city nearly $90 million worth of economic benefits. Brewerytown resident Cynthia Lombardi says knowing that may have made the draft more palatable, but she still thinks the city needs to improve its communication skills. Lombardi says she learned about the draft from a friend who sent her a link to an article.
There should be some kind of direct communication. I mean, not everybody can make these, you know, civic association meetings, so how are you supposed to find out? I wouldn't have known until I saw it on TV if this person didn't send me this email. And that was back in, like, the end of March.
Despite all the tweets, Facebook posts, and other online information the city has posted, those searching online for information are more likely to find news reports or even posts from the Visitors Bureau than information from the city. This fall, the city will be sitting down with community stakeholders to discuss events on the parkway. It'll be a debriefing of sorts, but also a chance for people to chime in with policy changes the city should consider going forward. One is already in the works. Lauren Hitt with the mayor's office says the city wants to make community engagement a requirement for all future event contracts. That way, the organization throwing the event and the city will share the responsibility of breaking the news to neighbors like Lombardi that their routines will once again be disrupted. I'm Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
The newly released State of the Air report points to progress in the Philadelphia region, though that's very much a relative term regarding ozone and particle pollution levels. Let's take a closer look at the American Lung Association study with its project director, Janice Nolan, Assistant Vice President of National Policy at the American Lung Association. Janice, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
What are the main takeaways from the study?
We have done this report now 18 times over the last nearly two decades, and one of the great positive report elements is the improvement in air quality across much of the nation, including in Philadelphia. We've seen much reductions in ozone pollution and in year-round particle pollution, though some places have had more problems with things like spikes in particle pollution. And we saw a lot of that, especially in the West. But Philadelphia has done much better this year than they've done in any other report on a couple of areas, at least.
What obvious reasons come to mind as contributing factors?
The Clean Air Act and the things that have been done as a result of that, including things like cleaning up coal-fired power plants, changing out and having lower emitting diesel equipment and vehicles like trucks and buses, and also everything that having cleaner fuels in it. All of those have helped to contribute to the reduction in pollution that we see in Philadelphia. And it's not just stuff that's being done locally, because Philadelphia, as part of the Northeast Mid-Atlantic, it's a lot of pollution from other areas blown into the area here. And so having reduced pollution across the nation has helped make the air cleaner in the Philadelphia area.
There is a call in the Trump administration to ease back on many regulations, including those pertaining to the Environmental Protection Agency and then the Clean Air Act. Is it possible to maintain or continue to improve air quality if that indeed takes place?
Well, there's a lot at play here, and some of them are things that we are in defending in the courts where challenges to EPA's actions have happened, and we will continue to defend them. So we'll see how those changes happen. We are urging the administration to make sure that they recognize the benefits of the Clean Air Act and the need to have these laws strong and enforced and funded, because those are the ways that we've been able to reduce pollution. They've talked about wanting to do that, to deal with air pollution. Well, here's the tool. We are concerned especially about the potential rollback of the Clean Power Plan because of the impacts that that will have on climate change. And we are hoping that the administration, in its review, considers that and reviews that and agrees to continue this very flexible program going forward. A lot of states are taking actions on their own, but as we know with air pollution, it doesn't stop on state boundaries. And so we've got to have a community effort, a nationwide effort to do this.
And so we can look at rankings, and the Philadelphia region ranks 22nd for ozone-polluted cities.
Well, the question is how much pollution? And sometimes the rankings, especially in the last few years, because we've had a lot of cities that improved and moved off the list. Philadelphia has ranked 22nd most pollution for ozone, but that's the best ever level they've ever had.
Though in some regards, looking at this report card, Philadelphia garners an F, and I'm looking at highest ozone days on average.
Yep, because it has too many. In this case, you got too many unhealthy air days, and that is compared to a national level that is recognized as being safer. It doesn't mean that you're as bad, for example, as Los Angeles. Everybody wants to make that comparison. But it does mean that the area still has a problem, and that while it's made a lot of improvement, it's not where you need to be. Well, it's gotten significantly better. I mean, the worst year that you had, by my count, was using the same scale that we're using today, was back in the late 90s, in 1997 and 1999, when you had 70 days on average. So now the worst county here is down to having 9 days on average. That's a big improvement, but we really are looking for more like 3 days on average or better to have healthier air.
Janice Nolan, thanks so much for shedding light on the latest study.
Thank you.
Janice Nolan is Assistant Vice President, National Policy at the American Lung Association. Philadelphia's City Council passes most bills with little or no debate and by unanimous majority. So it was a bit unusual last week when a measure with some outspoken opponents passed 11-6. The bill suspends a program allowing electric car owners to build curbside charging stations for their car and prohibit gas-powered cars from parking there. As WHYY's Jim Saxa reports, electric vehicle owners are trying to get Mayor Jim Kenney to veto the bill.
It may seem obvious, but electric vehicles need electricity. And in a city like Philadelphia, that can be a problem. We tend to park in the street, too far away from the nearest outlet. To fix this problem, the city passed an ordinance 10 years ago allowing owners of electric vehicles, or EVs, build a curbside charger and make the parking spot in front of it EV only. But council voted to suspend the program and allow anyone, not just electric cars, park in the EV-only spots during the day. After losing in council, EV owners have launched a Change.org petition asking Mayor Jim Kenney to veto the bill. Adam Novick wrote the petition and calls the rule change a bait and switch.
The program offered by the city had my family opting in and deciding to make the investment in the program. So we were excited about it when it was established, and we're certainly disappointed to see that they're looking to change the rules after the fact to the program that we signed on to.
Another EV owner, Lisa McGinty, says a guaranteed spot only at night won't work for her schedule.
I'm an emergency room physician, and I work at odd hours, so I'm charging in the day, sometimes at night, sometimes. If I can't charge that car, it's going to be difficult for me.
Since the original law went into effect, only 68 EV owners have filed for the special parking spots. That's out of 43,000 regulated on-street parking spaces in Philadelphia. But that was 68 too many for some jealous neighbors who complained to Councilman Mark Squilla that the EV program effectively privatized public on-street parking. At the same time, Squilla says such a small number demonstrates that the program is not working.
Two concerns. One is neighborhood parking, and it's a failed system. So there's two concerns. So parking is, anytime you have vehicles, parking is a concern. If you go to any community meeting throughout the city, any development that we talk about, parking always comes up.
EV owners say they care about clean air, not convenient parking. In fact, Nova cares so much about electric vehicles and clean energy, he gave his son the middle name Elon, as in Elon Musk, the founder of the electric car company Tesla. Speaking of green businesses, the bill is not a good look for a city that, until now, has done well supporting them, says Salim Chapman, a policy director for the Sustainable Business Network of Greater Philadelphia.
For such a long time, Philly has gotten it and really have been a leader in this way. But this policy is certainly a step back.
Mayor Kenney, who coincidentally sponsored the original EV parking legislation when he was still in council, has until the end of the week to either sign the bill or veto it. In a statement, the mayor said he was still evaluating the legislation. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
Among the activities in our region tying into Earth Day weekend, the inaugural Philadelphia Environmental Film Festival. Joining me are the festival's executive director, Deborah Wolf Goldstein, and artistic director, Alexandra Droback Dion. Deborah, Alexandra, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Dave.
Deborah, how did this idea come about for the first inaugural?
I'm an environmental attorney who's worked in this region for many years, and I've headed down to D.C. to see their environmental film festival for a couple years, and would always come back and think, why doesn't Philadelphia have an environmental film festival of its own?
I moved here from L.A., and I worked in the film industry in L.A., in art house films and blockbuster films, most notably at the side of James Cameron for many years. I joined him at the end of The Abyss, did all of Terminator 2 3 years, and then the beginning days of Titanic and the seeds of Avatar. And when Deborah mentioned the idea to me, it just struck me like lightning that this needed to be done. We did a quick Google search. We realized that most major cities in the world had an environmental film festival ranging from Abu Dhabi to Dakar to Amsterdam, and there was nothing in Philadelphia. It was a void that needed to be filled.
So, Deborah, did that make it easier, in a sense, to model the Philadelphia Film Festival on a successful festival in a different city?
Well, the first thing we did was talk to directors of film festivals in D.C. and Princeton and San Francisco, of environmental film festivals, and say, what do you wish you had known when you were starting out so that we could avoid some of those mistakes? And they, to a person, said, start out tight and strong, lean and mean, get the best movies you can, pack it full of good programming. And that's what we've done. We have 3 days of wonderful films on Earth Day weekend, April 21st through 23rd.
Shorts and feature releases. How many applications did you get, and what was the process to winnow it down?
We had over 230 films submitted from 34 countries worldwide. We had a panel of dedicated jurors, 7 jurors, who watched every single film and rated them. And for that, to them, we are eternally grateful. Then Deborah and I carefully made a selection, trying to do a well-curated selection of films that not only entertain but inspire. And we ended up with a slate of shorts and features. Some just celebrate the beauty of the planet and are whimsical, and some deal with profound issues.
Are they all relatively new?
They're all new.
How new?
Last year, 2016. Summer, I think there's one that's 2017.
And for listeners who already have some plans for the weekend, if they can only get to one or two of these films, do any immediately come to the top of the list?
That's a really hard call, because our opening night feature is Before the Flood with Leonardo DiCaprio, and we're honored that Fisher Stevens will be accepting the Environmental Advocacy Award at our inaugural festival in person and do a Q&A. But then it ranges to our closing night feature, which is Avatar for Throwback Sunday, which is one of the top 10 environmental feature films of all time. And between those two, we have 26 other films that are really strong, including a regional block and a youth block.
And Deborah, I understand it's not just a matter of watching films. There will also be some panel discussions.
We have a 13-year-old filmmaker coming in at the end of the youth block to talk about his film, Plastic is Forever. We have two highly esteemed documentary filmmakers coming in to talk about their film, Killing the Colorado, on Saturday afternoon. There's a film panel discussion on Friday afternoon as well. So people can come and meet the filmmakers. They can see the whole schedule on our website.
Speak to some of the existing resources in Philadelphia and the region that make it a perfect fit for an environmental festival.
Well, we were lucky to have early support from the Nature Conservancy, which is our founding sponsor, and our lead sponsor is the Natural Lands Trust, which is a media-based land conservation organization. And in addition to those two lead sponsors, we have a long list of community partners and foundations and individuals who have helped support this festival this inaugural year.
Alexandra, Deborah, you strike me as confident, enthusiastic, and relaxed. Aren't there last-minute details to attend to in anticipation of the kickoff?
I used to be one of those kind of people who needed 8 hours a night, and I have not been for many months. There are many details to attend to, and it's all going to, we're sure, come together and be a really wonderful film. And something else I wanted to point out for your listeners is that our weekend pass is only $30. For $30, you can see 26 amazing new films, animated documentaries, shorts, full-length features, or you can come see a single block, and each block has a feature film, a couple shorts, and those are only $11 for a ticket.
That entire package is over the course of the 3-day festival?
That's right, David.
So that's the complete package.
That's right.
Thank you both for joining us, and good luck with the festival.
Thank you, Dave.
It's the first Philadelphia Environmental Film Festival. I've been speaking with the executive director, Deborah Wolf Goldstein, and artistic director, Alexandra Drobak Dion. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. The Museum of the American Revolution opened today in Philadelphia. The $120 million museum tells the story of how the American experiment began, from its philosophical ideals to military combat to the foundation of government. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the opening had all the pomp and ceremony you'd expect from the opening of a museum devoted to the birth of a nation.
Elected officials, historians, a Broadway star from the musical Hamilton, and public radio commentator Cokie Roberts all said there's no better location for a museum about the American Revolution than right here, 3rd and Chestnut Streets in Philadelphia, just a stone's throw from Independence Hall. The Star Spangled Banner was sung by James McCorkle of the Curtis Institute.
Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet
One of the chief characteristics of this museum is its multi-perspective approach, featuring artifacts and stories from women, African Americans, Native Americans, even British loyalists, all of whom affected the revolutionary effort. Two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David McCullough pointed out that no one ever lives in the past. The founding generation lived in its own present, making decisions and suffering outcomes they could not anticipate.
They weren't perfect. They were human. Declaration of Independence begins with "when in the course of human events." The operative word is human, and we have to remember that.
The keynote speech was delivered by former Vice President Joe Biden, who lamented today's political discourse as more divisive than ever. Biden noted that the American national anthem is the only anthem he knows of that ends with a question: does that star-spangled banner yet wave?
And it will now and forever wave, but only if we hold on to it. Because it's not the flag that we're waving, it's what lives within us. Is it in our heart? Do we really understand and mean what this museum is about to celebrate?
Before the museum's opening, it had already exceeded its $150 million fundraising goal. Donations, both large and small, came in from 11,000 donors. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.